Yeah, I travel a lot. Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. China and the west of the USA. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
How are you?
Good.
Good. Yeah, yeah, yeah. How are you to New York?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. A lot of lectures. You
know. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Jakarta and Mumbai.
Oh. The world. So your room is changed.
969.
969. Okay. Maybe not come every time this semester. I may be selected, yeah, some lecture to this. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you. Okay. So another one session a week session. So let's get the most out of it. Okay, before I start, I want to ask this. This is the last time I'm going to ask this question because hopefully after this session it should not come up. Is there anybody who's not part of a group yet? Is there anybody who's not part of a group yet? Did I say, you hear a yes back there? If it is yes, just put up your hand because otherwise people can't see you. Okay. So I don't see any hands up, so I'm assuming that everybody has a group. Now, this is a question to which I don't want to know the answer. Have you picked a company yet? So as I said, I don't want to know the answer. I'm going to assume that you've all picked a company. So the answer is a unanimous yes, and if it isn't, fix it soon. Because the rest of the process can't get started until you pick a company. So don't wait for the perfect company. Pick one, get started. If you change your mind, you can always go back and redo the. It's not a big deal as long as you get the process started. So today we're going to talk about risk premiums, but let me start today's pre-class test by closing off a loophole, something I did not talk about, but at least directly, the session on risk-free rates. Let's suppose I come to you with a multinational. And let's face it, most companies are multinational now, right? Used to be 30 years ago when you talked about a multinational, you were talking about the exception. Now it's a rule. Let's make it a Swiss multinational. And let's assume it gets some of its revenues, 10% of its revenues in Switzerland, 30% of its revenues in the rest of the EU, 40% of its revenues in the US and 20% in India. So basically four parts of the world, and it's getting a mix of revenues from all over. And I've given you the risk-free rates and the currencies for each part. So I've given you the Swiss franc risk-free rate, the US dollar, the euro risk-free rate, and the Indian rupee risk-free rate. So this is the last thing I'm going to do on risk-free rates. But here's the only question I have related to this company. I'm trying to value this company. And I need a risk-free rate, obviously, to get started. And I'm going to give you the choices, and you tell me which choice you think is the right one to do the valuation in. I could take a simple average of the risk-free rates. Anybody with that choice? Okay, let's rule that out. The weighted average of the risk-free rates. Okay, I'm glad somebody put up their hand, no? Now, let's take this to the logical next step. Don't worry, I'm not going to beat you up here. Yeah? It sounds like it's the right thing to do because mechanically it's the most involved thing to do, right? Because you're taking the weights, you're bringing the risk-free rates. What's the problem? Somebody play devil's advocate here for me. What's the problem with using a weighted average of the risk-free rates? You can only value in one currency. Remember the example I gave you and I screwed up by going to the wrong planet? The last session, where I used Celsius and Fahrenheit. If I took the average temperature in Frankfurt and New York, one in Celsius and one in Fahrenheit, and I divided by two, or I took a weighted average based on the population, no matter what I do, it's going to be a screwed up number because I'm talking about two different measurement devices. So neither a simple average nor a weighted average. So let's rule both of those out. You cannot average risk-free rates. It's impossible to do because you have different measurement mechanisms. So now we're coming into our choice of which currency. Should I take the Swiss franc rate because it's a Swiss company? I could, right? But I don't have to. Remember we talked about this last session. If I take Lukoil, it's a Russian company, I can value it in US dollars a little more easily than I can value it in rubles. So don't feel constrained that you have to use the local currency to value a company. This is why I wanted to pick a company already, because if you picked a company, you can now think about the next step in the process, right? So if you picked a Honduran company or a Guatemalan company or a Peruvian company, it's true, you can value the company in the local currency, and I'd encourage you to do that because it makes you find out more about the local currency, but you don't have to. Should I take the lowest of the rates because we thought, didn't we use that requirement when we did the comparison of euro risk-free rates? We took the German 10-year. Can I use the same principle here and argue that if I'm looking for a risk-free rate globally, I have to go with the Swiss franc rate? Because then I should be valuing every company then in Swiss francs, right? If I follow that logic, I'm screwed. Every company then has to be valued in Swiss francs, or worse, it has to be valued in whatever. So you can't, again, compare across currencies. There I was able to pick the lowest rate. Why? When I was looking at the euro, they were all in the same currency. Once you're in the same currency, you can pick the lowest rate, but you're comparing across currencies. Don't play this game of, I want to be conservative in valuation. Remember we said in valuation, your objective is to come up with an expected value, not a low, not the lowest value you can. I'll save you the trouble. What's the lowest value you can give a company? Zero. So why are we wasting our time? What's the point of this conservative valuation business? After you've done your expected value, if you want to give me a minimum and a maximum value, be my guest. But don't pick risk-free rates simply because you want to come up with a conservative estimate. So I've kind of backed into an answer. The risk-free rate you should use should depend on what? What currency you choose to do your cash flows in. But you're saying, I have cash flows in different currencies. Deal with it. Convert all of them into Swiss francs, euros, Indian rupees, whatever currency you pick. And don't whine about it. That's the way this company is structured. That is, in fact, something you have to do, is pick a currency, and then the risk-free rate will reflect that currency choice. So if I'm valuing Nestle, and I decide to value it in US dollars, the risk-free rate I will use is the UST bond rate, assuming the US Treasury is default-free. If I value it in euros, the risk-free rate I will use is the German 10-year bond rate. If I'm valuing it in Swiss francs, the risk-free rate I will use is the Swiss franc risk-free rate. And you're going to be okay no matter which currency you pick, because it's going to self-correct, right? Because your cash flows then will have to be in that currency. With the inflation that's embedded in that currency, it will cancel out. And for the moment, just take it on faith. We'll come back and prove this when we're valuing multinational companies. So now let's talk about risk premiums. The historical risk premium, which we'll start off today's session with, is the way most people estimate equity risk premiums. And we'll come back and lay the foundation. What do we mean by historical? We look back at time. We look at the last 10, last 20, last 50, last 100 years. We look at what you'd have made investing in stocks as opposed to something risk-free, T-bills or T-bonds. That's a historical premium. So let's say your job is to value a company. You decide to come up with a historical premium for stocks. You have to, right? You have no choice if you're going to go down this road. So assuming you go down the historical premium route, I'm going to ask you how long a time period you're going to go back to compute your historical premium. You could go back just 1 year. You're saying the most recent data, so the argument you do is, so that'll be just looking at what stocks have done over the last year versus what T-bonds have done over the last year. You can take the last 5 years. Why? Because that's what you might have used to reflect current conditions. So 1 year is too short. 5 years will reflect an average since the last crisis. You could pick a time period, pick as long a time period as you have historical data for, which in the U.S. goes back to 1926, 18. In fact, Robert Shiller's data, I think, goes back to 1871. That's 145 years of data. Maybe you should match up your historical premium to the time period that you use for the risk-free rate. Remember, you said 10-year bond rate, so maybe you should be consistent and stay with 10 everywhere. Okay? Or maybe you should match up the time period to how long a time period you use to estimate your beta. Maybe you ran the regression with 5 years of data or 2 years of data. So you see the choice is 1-5, as long as you can go. Match it up to your risk-free rate time horizon. Match it up to your beta time horizon. Really, the choice is, do you want to go short and recent or long and maybe not relevant, right? What determines that choice? What are the things you got to weigh in? If I go back 1 year, what's the problem you're going to run? Let's say I decide to do this for a market that's collapsed over the last year. It's dropped 30%. What's the historical premium going to look like? It's going to be a negative number, right? If you then say, hey, from now on, I'm going to earn 20% below the risk-free rate in perpetuity, why are you wasting your time even looking at stocks? So 1 year clearly will not do. You're saying maybe 5 years, maybe 10. You know what determines whether you can go back 5 or 10 years is how much noise there is in stock prices. What's the standard error? It's something we forget in Stat 101, but when you compute an average premium over 5, 10, 20, or 50 years, that premium comes with a standard error. And one of the things we're going to look at today is how big that standard error is for stocks. And I'll tell you up front that if you're using 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or even 50 years, your data period is too short, which is going to create a problem for us. You know why? Because a lot of emerging markets, where the historical data you have goes back only 25 or 30 years. So if 50 years of data is not enough, you're saying, what do I do about those countries? We'll come back and talk about it. But you need a really long time period. Even 100 years, we're going to argue, is not that long in stock market history to get a historical premium. So let's say you decide to go back to 1926, which is where most of the U.S. databases go back to, is 1926 or 28. Before the Great Depression, you have 90 years of data. Right? So you compute a historical risk premium. You come up with a number. Let's say you come up with 4.6%. Through the end of 2014, that was the historical premium in the U.S., 4.6%. Where in September 2015, let's suppose the rest of the year is devastatingly bad. We end up with a minus 25% return in 2015. I'm not making any prognostications, so don't. Now, I've noticed people tweeting out while I'm talking. Already the tweet is going out. De Modrin predicts 25% drop in market. I'll be hearing about this for the rest of eternity. It's a hypothetical. But let's say you get to the end of 2000, it's been a terrible year. And you update your historical risk premium. So what have you done? You've taken the 1926 to 2014 data. You've added one extra year. One really bad year. You say, so what? What's going to happen to my historical risk premium that I report on January 1st of 2016? Is it going to go up or go down if I add this really bad year? Just think of the math, what I've done. What's going to happen? It's going to go down, right? You think, so what? So this would be a terrible 3 months, right? So if in December 31st the market's down 25%, you're looking back at the last 3 months and what are you seeing? An extraordinarily bad market. So I'm asking you, how risky are stocks to you, right? So what's your gut telling you? If it's been a really bad year at the end of the year, do you look back and stocks say, I feel really good about stocks now? Or your conclusion going to be, hey, stocks are a lot riskier than I thought they were? I would say that you feel a lot more risk after a bad year than a lot less. And you know what the historical premium is going to say? Oh, don't worry about it. Stocks just became less risky. This is exactly what happened in 2008. Adding 2008 to my historical data dropped the risk premium by 1%, a number that I argued didn't make any sense given how we were feeling about the riskiness of stocks. It's a fundamental problem with historical risk premiums. They always move in the wrong direction. Wrong direction where if the risk premium is the price you're charging for risk and it comes from how you feel about risk, the historical risk premium is always going to move in the other direction from the direction you want it to move to reflect your risk. So you're saying, what do we do? Historical risk premiums are so screwed up. I need to go back 100 years. They move in the wrong direction. Today I'm going to argue for what's called an implied premium. But before we go there, it sounds fancy. Let's lay the foundations for an implied premium. I need a couple of people here to be my guinea pigs. So since you're in front, you can be my guinea pigs. Let's suppose I give you an investment. I give you a cash flow, $1 a year guaranteed, so there's no risk in the cash flow, in perpetuity. How much would you pay for that investment? $10, okay. If you pay $10 for that investment, what are you going to make as a rate of return on it? Each year you're going to make 10%, right? If you can find me an investment where I can make 10% guaranteed, you found perfect arbitrage. But that's fine. So you're saying 10% is what I would need for a guaranteed investment. Let me stay with you and change the example a little bit. Let's assume now I came to you with the same investment, same cash flow of a dollar, but now it's an expected cash flow. So it's not guaranteed anymore. And the risk in that cash flow is about the risk in the equity market, whatever you think that risk is. Would you pay less for this investment now or more? So give me a number. Eight. So what did that return work out to? 1 over 8 is 12.5%. Your equity risk premium is 2.5%. Do you see where the 2.5% came from? You told me what you would pay for a riskless investment, and you told me what you'd pay for a risky investment. It's less, obviously. I can back out from what you pay what your risk premium is. Sounds incredibly abstract. So how many people are going to offer me a dollar in guaranteed cash flows? You're right. That might be a completely arbitrary example, but we're going to take that principle that if I know what you pay for something, I can back out from this, what your risk premium is what I'm going to bring to stocks and say, you tell me what you pay for the S&P 500. And every moment of every day, you get that number, right? What the market is willing to pay. I should be able to back out of that number what your risk premium is. So let's go back to the notes and I think we were on page 42, so we're going to start on page 43. So let's lay the foundation. So we're going to talk about equity risk premiums today. And essentially, the way to think about the equity risk premium is what you would demand over and above your risk-free rate for investing in equities as a class. Not in any particular stock, but collectively in stocks. And as I said, the way in which people estimate equity risk premiums is to look at the past, a historical risk premium. Now, having said that, though almost everybody out there uses historical risk premiums, when I go around in the summer and I go to different investment banks and I talk to their equity research groups and their M&A groups, I usually ask them a question. What are you guys using as your equity risk premium today in valuation? Just to collect the numbers out there. And you'll be amazed at how wide a variance I get. And they all claim to be using the same historical data. This summer, for instance, the numbers range anywhere from 3% to 8%, depending on which bank I was in, and within each bank, who I was talking to. So if I talked to equity research people, they were giving me the 3% number. And if I talked to the M&A people, they might have been using the 9% number. So basically, you can have numbers all over the place. Which raises an interesting question. How can you all be looking at the data and coming up with these different numbers? And here's a simple answer. It depends on how you define your historical time period, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 75 years, 85 years, you get different risk premiums. It depends on what you call risk-free. Some people compare to the T-bill rate, which is the short-term government rate, some to the T-bond rate. You get different risk premiums. And it depends on how you compute your average. You see, what do you mean? There's only one way to compute an average. With 86 years of data, add 86 numbers, divide by 86. That's an arithmetic average. The other way to compute an average is a geometric average. You take the compounded average where you look at what would have happened if you'd invested in 1928, $100. What is it worth today and looking at the compounded average? How far back do you go? What do you define as risk-free, arithmetic or geometric averages? I told you at the start of every year on my website, I update these numbers. And I update them for three slices of history. So it's not even every slice because obviously you can get a lot more. I go back to 1928, which is the starting year for my data. 1965, which is about 50 years of data, and 2005, which is 10 years of data. So about 87 years, 50 years, and 10 years, risk premiums are all different. I look at premiums over T-bills and T-bonds, again, very different. And I look at arithmetic averages and geometric averages, and look at, if you, for instance, you look at stocks versus T-bonds, an arithmetic average premium is 6.25%, the geometric average is 4.6%. Now do you see why analysts love this table? No matter what risk premium you want to use, you can justify it. Just pick the number in the table and say, I'm using 8%. Look, it's there. I'm using 3.5%. Oh, look, it's there. It's an incredible cop-out because it means you don't take responsibility. So I'm going to argue that if you're going to use a historical risk premium, I'm going to push you on it. And here's the reason you need to be careful. See this 4.6%? That's a long-term geometric average premium for stocks over T-bonds. If I were forced to use a historical risk premium, that is the number I would use. Why? Because I have to go back a long period because see these numbers below the 6.25 and the 8%? Those are the standard errors in my estimates. Sounds abstract, but let me try this out on you. If I claim the risk premium over the last 87 years is 4.6% a year, that sounds impressive until I tell you that the standard error in my estimate is 2.3%. Think statistics 101. Remember the plus or minus 2 standard error? If I plus or minus 2.3% times 2 from 4.6%, what's my range look like? 0 at one end, 9.2 at the other. In other words, I can tell you the equity risk premium of the U.S. is some number between 0 and 9.2%. Fat lot of good that does you. And that's with 87 years of history. If I go to 10 years of history on this false premise that I'm getting a more updated number, my risk premium is 2.73%. Notice the second decimal point. The standard error in that number is 8.65%. So if I tell you the risk premium is 2.7% and I tell you the standard error is 8.7%, I might as well have told you nothing. The next time you see an analyst saying, I'm valuing Indian stocks using a historical risk premium for India over the last 20 years, ask him what the standard error in that number is. He'll have no idea what you're talking about. And that should tell you more about how people use these numbers than any other statistic. I'm going to make a strong argument in this class that you should not use historical risk premiums. You should not use historical risk premiums because obviously they're backward looking. You should not use historical risk premiums because they're noisy. Noisy being the standard error is big. And here's a final rationale against why you should not use historical risk premiums. The noise in the estimate actually is very simply computed by taking the standard deviation in stocks, an annualized standard deviation, with U.S. stocks have been about 20%, and dividing by the square root of the number of years of data that you have. So if you want a quick and dirty estimate of what the standard error is in an estimate, that's all you need to do is take the annualized number and divide by the square root of. And that's why in emerging markets it gets even dicier, because the standard deviation on an annualized basis in Indian stocks is closer to 30 to 35%. You divide that by the square root of 10 or 20. You can very quickly see why these numbers mean almost nothing. There's another slightly more insidious problem here. What's the database I'm looking at? U.S. data, right? Why do I look at U.S. data? Because that's where the most data is. So if you look at Jeremy Siegel's book, stocks always win in the long run. An absurd argument. Because if it were true, you know what your equity risk premium should be if you have a long time horizon? If you buy into the premise that stocks always win in the long term, what should your equity risk premium be if you have a 40-year time horizon? Zero. No wonder Jeremy's so bullish all the time. Because if your risk premium is zero, the S&P 500 should be at 4,000. It's absurd because we know that he's looking at the U.S. market. We also know that the most successful equity market of the 20th century was the U.S. market. You've taken the most successful equity market of the last century, and you're extrapolating from that the risk premiums you're going to get by investing in stocks for the next century. You're asking for trouble. And for the longest time, the defense we used to offer was, what else can we do? This is the only market for which we have historical data going back in time. We no longer have that excuse. Elroy Dimson and Marsh, I mean, Paul Marsh, there are two professors at London Business School, in conjunction with Credit Suisse every year, publish historical risk premiums, not for one market, but for 20 different markets. In fact, I'm going to show you the graph that they have, or the table that they have across markets. So basically, if you go back to 1900 and you look at the data, you'll actually see for each of the markets what they've computed. So this is not just the U.S., it's across markets. You think, how is this going to help me get over the survivor bias? If it were 1900 and you are a wealthy investor, you can put yourself wherever you want in the world, and you decide to invest in stocks, unless you had incredible foresight, you'd have had no idea which market was going to succeed over the 20th century, right? So if I asked you what your risk premium is, it has to be across all markets, not just the most successful market. The average across the world, the geometric average premium, is 3.2%. What was it just for the U.S.? I know it's not matched up correctly, but in here, just for the U.S. is 4.4%. The reason the numbers are different is the previous table went back to 1928. This goes back to 1900. The selection bias that comes about because we focused on the U.S. is 1.2%. We're overstating our risk premiums. This is even if you trust historical data. We're overstating our risk premiums by going back and looking at just the U.S. So what I'm building is a case against historical risk premiums. The reason I do that is not just to convince you, but you're going to be going up against people who will argue why shouldn't I use historical risk premiums? That's the way I was taught to estimate equity risk premiums in class. You might not be able to talk them out of it, but use the three arguments. You are backward-looking, and that's obvious. The estimate that you have is a noisy estimate. They'll have no idea what you're talking about. Estimate the standard error for them. And third, talk about the selection bias. You're looking at the U.S. market, and you're extrapolating from the most successful market of the last century. Now, obviously, if you decide to go this historical route, you cannot estimate a risk premium for outside the U.S. You're not going to get 85 years, 100 years, 150 years of data. In almost any market outside the U.S., including most European markets, you have periods where the market stopped trading. Second World War, for instance, lots of European markets shut down. So we face a challenge in terms of estimating equity risk premiums for other countries. So I'm going to give you three ways in which you can think about what the risk premium should be for a Brazil and India and Indonesia, Russia, China. The first is to build on a number we already used as a measure of country risk. Remember when we were trying to come up with risk-free rates in Indian rupees or Chinese renminbi or Indonesian rupiah? The way we did that was we started with the government bond rate in the local currency, right? The Indian rupee government bond rate. Then what did we do? We looked up the default spread for the country. We got in one of three ways. Either by looking at a government bond issued by that country denominated in dollars or euros, by looking at the CDS market, or by just looking at the rating. And then we subtracted that out from the government bond rate to get to risk-free rate. I know it's a measure of default risk. That's what we're... But you could argue that maybe if that's the only measure I have, that should also become your proxy for the risk in a country. I hate to say this, but this is the reality. In most investment banks, this is the state of the art for estimating equity risk premiums in other countries. They will start with a U.S. equity risk premium that they get from the historical data, 5, 6, 4, whatever they chose from that table. Then if you ask them, what's the risk premium for Brazil? They will look up the default spread for Brazil, either from the CDS market or from a government bond or from its rating. They will add that default spread on to the U.S. risk premium, and they'll come up with a risk premium for Brazil. So let me put some numbers in. Let's assume your risk premium for the U.S. is 5.75%. And let's say that you come up with a default spread of 1.9%, and this is in January 2015. Remember, the rating for Brazil was Baa2. The default spread was 1.9%. You take the 1.9% of the and add it to the 5.75%. You come up with an equity risk premium of 7.65%, and you move on. You can already see the flaws here, right? The first flaw is I'm measuring country risk with a default spread. So the first argument you can make is that's what you would charge for buying a Brazilian government bond. So the additional spread is for the default risk. But you're buying Brazilian equities. So the first argument you can make is this is a risk in a bond, a government bond. What I want is a risk in Brazilian equities. It's not capturing it. And you'd be absolutely right, but you can see why people like default spreads. They're out there. You can observe them. You can add them on. You can defend them. You can move on. But this is the first approach to dealing with country risk. I would say 90% of country risk premiums come from just adding the default spread. I'm going to give you two other ways of getting the country risk premium if you don't like this one. The first avoids the government bonds entirely. It looks at the standard deviation, the equity index in that country, and compares it to the standard deviation in the U.S. You're saying, how is that going to help me? Let's put some numbers in. Let's assume the equity risk premium you have for the U.S. is 5.75%. Again, that's coming from that historical table. You pick the number. Let's say the standard deviation in the S&P 500 is 18%, and the standard deviation in the Bovespa, which is the Brazilian equity index, is 21%. Let's set up an algebra problem. You're investing in the U.S. market with an 18% standard deviation. The equity risk premium you're demanding is 5.75%, right? If you're investing in the Brazilian market, which has a standard deviation of 21%, which is higher than the 18%, you should demand a bigger risk premium. And in fact, all that's done is you take the 5.75% and you scale it up to reflect the higher risk of the Brazilian equity market. Goldman Sachs came up with this probably 20 years ago as their way of adjusting for risk premiums. Sounds pretty intuitive, right? You just have to get the standard deviations, and the higher standard, the riskier markets will have higher standard deviation, therefore they will have higher risk premiums. Is that true, though, that riskier markets have higher standard deviations? What if I told you the Egyptian market has a really low standard deviation? It does. You know why? It's low liquidity. How do we measure standard deviation? The price has to change. For the price to change, what has to happen? Somebody's got to trade the stock, right? So if your trading volume goes towards zero, your standard deviation will go towards zero. Which means if you use this approach, Ivory Coast should have an equity risk premium one-fifth of the U.S. Pakistan should have about half the risk premium of the U.S. The least liquid markets will end up with really, really low risk premiums. So if you use this approach, remember that potential problem. You're going to understate. And some of those equity risk premiums, you're going to look and say, no way. So I'll give you my third approach, and this is an approach I concocted. I'll use this word repeatedly because most of the things I do I don't derive, because I'd suggest deep thought and intellectual exercise. I concoct, simply because I get desperate. My concocted approach actually steals from the first approach and the second approach, and here's what I do. I start with the U.S. standard deviation as my basis premium for a mature market. So I put that in. I look up the default spread for the country, just like in the first approach, but I add one more layer. I say that's the spread I would charge for buying a government bond issued by that country. What if I could look up the standard deviation in that bond? So in the case of Brazil, the standard deviation of the government bond was about 14%. And the standard deviation of the equity was 21%. It's just like approach two, but instead of comparing the Ivory Coast equity market to the U.S. equity market, I'm going to compare the Ivory Coast equity market to the Ivory Coast government bond. Implicitly, I'm assuming that if you have low liquidity in one, you're also going to have low liquidity in the other. And most of the time, it works out. So in this case, if I take the default spread of 1.9% for Brazil, I scale it up for the higher risk of equity, I come up with an equity risk premium or an additional equity risk premium for Brazil of 2.85%. Higher than what I got in approach one because I'm now scaling up the default spread. And that is the number that I'm going to add on top of the 5.75% to come up with the equity risk premium for Brazil. So the start of every year, I do this. In fact, if you want the July 2015 update, it's on my website. So you saw this in my corporate finance class as well. Is I take every country for which I can get a default spread. That's about 127 countries. To get a default spread, I either need a CDS for the country or I need at least a Moody's rating for a country. Because if you have a CDS, I can use it. If you have a Moody's rating, I can use the lookup table. So I'll tell you up front, there are about 35 countries that are not on this page, and we'll talk about what to do if you're investing in any of those countries. So 127 countries, I get their default spreads. I scale up the default spread for the additional risk of equity. I add it on to my base premium, which in this case is my U.S. premium. And obviously, if that number is screwed up, every other number is also going to be screwed up. So I'm going to come back and talk about why I was using 5.75% for the U.S. at the start of 2015, because it definitely did not come from the historical table, which, say, gave me 4.6 or 8 or whatever else. I started with 5.7. Notice there are a lot of countries where the equity risk premium is the same as the U.S. I'll give you a listing of the countries. Canada, you got Germany, you got France, not even France. You got Germany, you got Finland, you got Australia, New Zealand. What do they share in common? What are the countries which all have the same premium as the U.S.? Think about how I computed the premium, right? I start with the U.S. premium. I look up your default spread as a country, which comes from whether you have default risk as a country. So what you see as 5.75% total premiums for any country which has a AAA rating, I know it's incredibly sloppy, but think of the alternative. You've got to be a country specialist, right? So in this case, I've taken every AAA rated country and attached the same premium to that country as I do for the U.S. If you're not AAA rated, then the rest of my job has to kick in. So you're AA, BBB, B, triple C, whatever. I've got to come up with a default spread for your country. I've got to scale up the default spread, add it on to the 5.75%. you need this entire table no matter what company you're valuing. You say, but I'm valuing a U.S. company. In a few minutes, you're going to see. It doesn't matter where your company is incorporated. You need this entire picture. Now, in my corporate finance class, I've also mentioned that this is the most downloaded data set on my website by far. It gets used in the strangest places. I'll give you an example. When I look at my blog, I check to see what parts of the world you can actually see in Google blog where people are reading your blog from. And the usual culprits I usually know, right? You have US, you're going to have Canada, I mean, all the English-speaking countries. And India, of course, has a big contingent because, you know, there are enough, I guess, English-speaking financial analysts there, and last names make a difference, I guess, so I get a natural contingent there. But about 2 months ago, I was checking, and I noticed Lithuania in the second spot. I said, what? What are these Lithuanians doing coming out and checking my website? So I started exploring, and it turns out that the Lithuanian Energy Commission was using my risk premiums when people were bidding for, you know, whatever, you know, contracts, that they were using my risk premium as a basis for deciding whether these contracts were being bid for correctly. Nobody from Lithuania reached out to me about doing this. Frankly, I don't care, but I think part of the pull is it's free. You're not paying anybody. But the other part is, even though I said it's concocted, it's transparent. Transparent in what sense? You can very quickly reverse engineer every single number here because all you need to do is go look up the rating, look up the spread, and you got the number. Hey, I don't sit there saying, I hate Venezuela, I'm going to push up the risk premium, I love Brazil, I'll lower the risk premium. There is no intellectual input that I put in other than looking up. And that's a big plus in a world where all kinds of agendas go into country risk, where people push in their favored countries and not so favored countries. But as I said, I need this entire table when I do valuation, no matter where a company is incorporated and listed, because it's business maybe all over the globe. So what I'd like to talk about is what to do with these country risk premiums, and actually three different approaches I'd like to take you through. The first is to add the country risk premium as a constant. Remember we talked about the CAPM, risk-free rate plus beta times equity risk premium? So here's what I'm going to do to modify that equation. I'm going to take the risk-free rate in whichever currency you've decided to do your valuation in. I'm going to take your beta, and we'll come back and talk about it because that's a number we haven't talked about yet. I'm going to multiply the beta by a mature market premium, 5.75% at the start of 2015. And then if you're a Brazilian company or you have a business in Brazil, I'm going to add an extra 2.85% to it on top. So risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium plus a country risk premium on top. So I'm not going to multiply the country risk premium by beta, it just is going to be added on. In the second approach, which is a very mild variant in the first one, I bring the 2.85% into the brackets and I multiply by a beta. So if your beta is close to 1, the first two approaches will give you roughly the same answer. If your beta is different from 1, the two approaches will diverge. And what I'm implicitly assuming in the second approach is if you have a high beta, in other words, you're more exposed to all the other risks, you're also more exposed to country risk. A big assumption, but the first one is also an assumption. I'm assuming that every company is equally exposed to country risk. In the third approach, I create a variable to measure how exposed you are to country risk. I'm going to call it lambda. Okay. Why lambda? Again, putting in a Greek alphabet adds that layer of sophistication that makes people afraid to critique you. So lambda is just like a beta. What are the properties of betas? They're scaled around 1, right? So if your beta is 1, you're as risky as the average stock. A lambda looks just like a beta in the sense that it's scaled around 1. So if your lambda is 1, you're as exposed as the typical company in that market to country risk. If your lambda is above 1, you're more exposed than the typical company. Lambda less than 1, you're less exposed. And I'll give you a little bit of history as to how I concocted this particular measure. So about 15 years ago, I was on a flight to Brazil to do a valuation seminar in Sao Paulo. And I'd picked a couple of Brazilian companies to value. And one was a company called Ambev, which is one of Latin America's biggest beverage companies. At that time, it was almost entirely a Brazilian beverage company. Now it's become much more Latin American in terms of other countries. And the other was a company called Embraer. Embraer is a Brazilian aerospace company. In fact, if you've taken a short-haul flight in the U.S., you've either probably taken a Bombardier aircraft or an Embraer aircraft. So the next time you're in one of those little planes which make you feel a little claustrophobic, you know what I'm talking about? Okay. Check out that card in the front seat, because about half of them are Embraer. So Embraer is an aerospace company. Both Brazilian companies. And at that time, as I was flying, I was actually doing the conventional thing, treating them as Brazilian companies, punishing them for being Brazilian companies equally. In other words, adding the same country risk premium to both and valuing both companies. So on my flight, it's a long flight. It's like a 12-hour flight. I couldn't sleep. So I was checking through the annual reports of these two companies just to make sure I hadn't missed something. When I came to a pie chart in the Embraer annual report, and in the pie chart they reported where they got their revenues. And in 2003, which is the year that I was doing this, they got 3% of their revenues in Brazil. 3%. And 97% of their revenues in North America and Western Europe. So I pulled up the Embev annual report, checked to see if I could find, and I found a pie chart in the Embev annual report. And in 2003, Embev got about 95% of its revenues in Brazil and 5% from the rest of Latin America. Both Brazilian companies, both exposed to Brazilian country risk. But I said, these two companies are not equally exposed to Brazilian country risk. I would expect, which of these two companies should be expected to be less exposed?
Embraer.
So I said, you know what? They're both Brazilian companies, but I'm not going to add it. Remember in 2003, the country risk premium for Brazil was about 10% on top of the U.S. premium. This is a big number. So I said, you know what? For Embev, I'm going to add the entire 10%. For Embraer, I can't add the 10%. I've got to scale it down to reflect the fact that they're less exposed. So that's when I concocted this measure lambda. I hadn't even thought of measuring it. I show up in Brazil. I make this pitch that we have to measure it differently. And of course, somebody asked me, you know, pain in the neck guy, asked me, how exactly are you going to measure lambda? I'd already named it. That's a good thing. I named it first and then thought about it later. So I said, you know what? I haven't thought about it yet, but I have a long flight back. In fact, on that flight back, I actually wrote an entire paper. That's how bored I got on that flight. There was no, I think the movie thing broke down and I couldn't fall asleep. There was a fat guy next to me who kept moving around. So I said, you know what, might as well get some work done. So I sat down and I wrote a paper. In fact, I'll send you the link to it. It's an extraordinarily fascinating, gripping paper. It's about estimating lambdas. What are the things? And so I'll take you through the process of how I tried to estimate lambda. And some of it will be intuitive, some of it is not, but those are the three choices. But in all three choices, I need a country risk premium. That country risk premium comes from the approach we've talked about before. So for the first two approaches, here's a sub-choice you're going to come up with. The first is to base your country risk premium entirely based on where the company's incorporated, right? That was the old conventional wisdom. If you have Embev and Embraer, they're both Brazilian companies, they should be given the Brazilian country risk premium. And I think it's absurd because you use that rationale, Coca-Cola is a U.S. company, and you're done, right? U.S. equity risk premium. Apple is a U.S. company. Let's apply the U.S. equity risk premium. So the second approach says, look, it doesn't matter where you're incorporated. It matters where you do business. So I'm going to compute the equity risk premium across the parts of the world where you have operations. And to me, at least, the choice between these two seems a slam dunk. That increasingly what we have are global companies that through the accident of history happen to be incorporated in Mumbai or Sao Paulo or wherever else, but they're all global companies. So Vale is a Brazilian company. Rio Tinto might not be. Or is it an Australian company? No. But it doesn't matter. They're all global mining companies that compete in the same space. So if I can figure out a way to weight their operations, I can get an equity risk premium. So I'll give you the way in which I try to do it, and I'll give you the limitations of what I've done. I take their revenues, and I look at the breakdown by revenues. Most companies do this. Some companies do it better than others. As you remember from your experience in corporate finance and your frustrations, some companies are incredibly opaque about revealing this very basic detail. So here, for instance, I have Embraer in 2004. 3% of its revenues are in Brazil, 98% from mature markets. The equity risk premium I'd have used would have been a weighted average of 97% times a mature market premium, which in 2003 was 5%, or 2004. And for the Brazil, it was 12.89%. The weighted average would have been barely higher than my mature market premium. Why? Because the only thing Brazilian about it is its name and where it's incorporated. Right? We'll talk about the limitations of focusing on revenues because you can already see one of the weak links, right? Because where does Embraer, in 2004 at least, where was Embraer making all its aircraft? It was in Brazil. So I'm looking at just the revenue side. I'm not looking at the production side. And that's one of the flaws here, right? Because I'm probably understating the risk premium for Embraer by focusing on where it gets its revenue. And I'll talk about why I start with revenues first. The other is Embev. As I said, in 2004, it was almost entirely a Brazilian company. This was updated to 2011. Embev now is no longer just a Brazilian company. It's incorporated in Brazil. It trades in Brazil. But its revenues, if you look at where they're broken out, 64% comes from Brazil. Its next biggest market is Canada. And the way they've got these foothold is either by exporting Guarana to Canada or by buying local beverage makers and essentially becoming a more global company. So the way I computed equity risk premiums, I took the revenues, I added them all up and computed the weights of each market. Make sure your weights add up to 100%. That's the only requirement. And you get an equity risk premium for Embev that reflects where it does business. Now, let me actually play devil's advocate on my own approach. I'm using revenues, right? One of the problems, as we pointed out, is when you use revenues, you miss the fact that your production facilities might all be in Brazil or whatever part of the world you're in. And if that country goes to hell in a handbasket, it doesn't matter that your revenues come from the US, you're going to feel the heat. That's the first problem. The second, you say, why revenues? Value is based on what? Not revenues, right? Cash flows. You say, why not look at something closer to cash flows? Some companies, for instance, report EBITDA by region. But only about 20% of companies report EBITDA by region. Almost every company will report revenues by region. About 20% will use EBITDA. But even for that 20%, I choose not to use EBITDA, and here's my biggest rationale why. Of course, EBITDA could reflect the true earnings power of each of these regions, right? You know what else it reflects? Where you pay your taxes. Your Irish subs, EBITDA, will always look magically high. Why? Because you pay the least taxes there. When you talk about EBITDA and EBIT, you're talking about accounting earnings. Somebody's allocating expenses across these regions, right? And they're not doing it based on what's fair. They're doing it based on other factors playing in. I don't trust EBIT numbers. I don't trust EBITDA numbers. So I use revenues because it's available for almost every company, and it's a number accountants can do the least damage on. And that's a big factor in weighting, right? I'll tell you the only exception. With natural resource companies, if I can, I try to find where the reserves are. Do you see why that's a big issue? So if you take a natural resource, almost all oil companies sell their oil into a global oil market denominated in dollars, right? But if all of your reserves are in Nigeria or Kazakhstan or Georgia, that's a problem. So if you can get information on where reserves are geographically, maybe that's what you should weight it based on. But leave open that door. You're trying to bring in operating risk through these weights. I start with revenue weights, but it doesn't have to be the defining measure. You could pick something else as long as you think it measures exposure to. In fact, you can even bring both in. You can have half your weight on revenues and half on where your operations are. And it's always still going to be better than just using the country in which a company is incorporated and using that country's risk premium. So this, for instance, is Coca-Cola, U.S. company, but you can see the breakdown. Incidentally, Coca-Cola does not break down revenues by country. And there's a simple reason. If you break it down by country, it's 75 countries. They break it down by region. And if you go back a couple of pages to the map that I showed you, notice there's a regional average here. Those regional averages are actually weighted averages. Weighted averages of the equity risk premiums, the countries in that region, weighted by the GDP of each country. So in Asia, China obviously has a much bigger weight than Vietnam does, and it should. So the reason I compute those weighted averages for companies like Coca-Cola, where I will not have revenues for every country, but I will have revenues by region, and there's my weighted average. So I know it sounds like a lot of work, but I don't see a way you can avoid doing this anymore. This is the dark side of globalization, at least from the perspective of doing valuation. Life just got a lot more complicated than it used to be. But if you're going to count the good stuff from globalization, which we do all the time, right? We're going to globalize. We're going to grow. This has to be the other side of the growth, is you've got to bring in the risk story. So you're looking at a company that's deciding on two different strategies. One is a strategy where they stay national, and this is all they're going to do. Uber versus Lyft, right? Uber's clearly gone the global route. It wants to be everywhere and everything. Lyft has very consciously, at least for the moment, decided that it's going to be just U.S.-based. Now, we can talk about all the other aspects of these choices, but one of the places it will show up is when I value Lyft, the equity risk premium I'll be using is just the U.S. equity risk premium. When I'm valuing Uber, I'm looking at a global equity risk premium. For the moment, that's going to be a secondary issue in the valuation because the numerator is where the uncertainty is. But you can see how your strategic choices as a company will feed into your equity risk premium and through it into your valuation. Any questions on equity risk premiums? And yes? Well, it's actually a very good question. I told you the worst culprits on this are in the U.S. An incredibly large number of U.S. companies break their revenues down as follows. We get 71% of our revenues in the U.S., 29% from the rest of the world. Come on, guys. The rest of the world is a really big place. Either you don't know where you're selling outside the U.S., in which case I'm going to act as if you don't have the 29%. Or you do and you're not telling me. If you have the rest of the world, first, you're mad at the company. And I'll give you ways of taking that frustration out in the valuation. But here's what I do. I have the equity risk premiums for the other countries. I take a weighted average of... So in fact, if you go to the spreadsheet I'll send you after class today, I'm going to give you the spreadsheet with equity risk premiums for every country, the GDP for every country. You can create whatever combined messes you want to. Okay? Because companies do incredibly nonsensical things when in terms of breaking down geographical revenues. They'll break Asia up into parts you've never even realized you could break Asia up into. So what the heck are you doing? Okay. But you can't fight it. You've got to take the information you have, use those equity risks, and make your best judgment. Incidentally, I did mention that there were about 35 countries for which I could not give you equity risk premiums. What do they share in common? They don't have a rating or a CDS. So the first thing you know is these are countries that are really safe countries or really risky countries. So it's going to be countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, Syria. So the first thing you know is if you're going to these countries, demand a huge risk premium. That, of course, doesn't help you, but it's a starting point, right? So I actually have the spreadsheet I will send you. I've actually estimated the equity risk premiums for those 35 countries as well. And I had to stretch every conceivable model that I have to get a number. So here's what I did. I can't get ratings for those countries. Okay? But I can get a score called a PRS score. PRS is this political risk service. It's a Europe-based service that actually comes up with numerical scores by country. The scores range from, I think, 20 to 100, depending on how much risk there is. And they actually have risk scores for Iran and Afghanistan and Syria. So somebody help me out here. What do you think I did? So let's say I want a risk premium for Syria. I have a score of, let's say, I think the lower the score, the higher the risk. Don't ask me why this is. Let's say the score for Syria is 37. You know what I did? I went looking for other countries with roughly the same score, which had a rating. So complete the story. Once I find those three other countries which have scores between 35 and 40, which have a rating, I looked at the equity risk premiums I estimated for those three countries, averaged them out, and used it for Syria. You're saying, that is quite a stretch. If you can come up with a better way of doing it, just let me know. Okay? As I said, I'm not suggesting this is the end game, but you need a number. You can't just say high risk premium, because if I put just high into the total equity risk premium, my Excel spreadsheet comes back with a valuation error. I need a number. So this is desperation time. Do whatever you need to do to come up with a number if that's where. So you're looking at a Halliburton, You have to deal with these things because often their contracts are in the parts of the world. These are called frontier markets often because they're markets where people aren't even going in because there's so much risk. But within that country, there will be people having to make investment decisions. And I feel, they have to use some number, some hurdle rate within the countries to make the judgment. Might as well make your best estimate. Okay? So as I said, the focus on revenues can be a problem, and that can lead to other issues. Yes?
Is one of the assumptions here that the market is able to correctly assess default risk?
Okay, the question is one of the assumptions here that the market is able to correctly assess default? I'll tell you the bigger assumption. What am I basing that default spread on? The ratings, right? The bigger assumption is, when I'm using the Moody's ratings to come up with it, is the ratings agencies are getting the default risk measures right. That's a much bigger assumption than actually that the market. If I use the CDS market, you could argue, maybe it's a market-based measure. This is actually a rating-based measure. So when I screw up, guess where I'm going to screw up? It's in those countries where Moody's says, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry. Oh, my God, they're bankrupt. Because then I'm going triple A, triple A, triple A. Oh, gone. Okay. Or when Moody's plays games, like when right after 2008, when they decide to separate AAA into strong AAA and weak AAA. This is like being mildly pregnant or very pregnant. You're either AAA or not. Make up your mind. So I'm at the mercy of whatever the ratings are. And I know that right now ratings agencies are not high in the public esteem rankings. But I don't think that they're biased. I think they're just late to the game. So when ratings agencies screw up, it's because they take too long to fix their mistakes. That's why also, if you go to the spreadsheet I'll send you today, I have a second measure, which is based on the CDS. So Brazil, for instance, the CDS has run ahead of the ratings. So starting in January, you saw the CDS spreads in Brazil start to widen out. It's only in the last couple of months that the ratings agencies have finally come around and said, oh my God, there's more risk in Brazil. So that's, I think, a problem with basing it on default risk. There's another problem. Are there countries where you could have a lot of political risk but not much default risk? It's an entire region of the world I can think of. Not much default risk, lots of political risk. I'm going to do my first valuation seminar in the Middle East in Dubai in January. You take Dubai, you take Saudi Arabia, how much default risk is there in those countries? Almost nothing, because the governments don't borrow money. They've got incredible oil wealth coming in. They don't borrow money. So if you measure ratings for these countries, they're really high because the ratings agencies are doing their job. There's no default risk in these countries. But as we saw with the problems, especially in the last couple of years, where you take countries that look stable until they don't, there's political risk in these countries. So the other problem with these measures is because I'm basing it on default risk, I might be missing that political risk component. So to me, this is a work in progress. I'm going to keep working on better ways of bringing this in because there's no alternative. We're part of a global economy, and we've got to bring that into this equity risk premium somewhere along the way. So a little bit about lambdas. As I said, as I was on the flight back from Sao Paulo, I started thinking about, hey, what are the things that should go into a lambda? And I started listing all of the things that I would look at. One, obviously, was where your revenues. So if you're embedded, the fact that 97% of your revenues come from outside Brazil is going to be a factor in giving you a low lambda. Then I said, you know, where are your operations? Where are your factories? So that became a second factor. If all of your factories are in Brazil, obviously I have to be a lot more worried about country risk, so your lambda should go up. So your lambda goes down if you have less revenues in Brazil. It goes up if you have more of your operations in Brazil. The third question I asked was, how much flexibility do you have in actually moving your operations if things go bad? I'll give you a contrast. If things go bad in Brazil, it's going to be very difficult for Embraer to move because its factories are big assembly plants. If things go bad in India, it's not going to be that difficult for Infosys to move because what's its operation base? Thousands of software engineers in a building in Bangalore. So basically, you get four big aircraft, you put them all on, you send them off to, I don't know where, Switzerland. So go hang out there for a few years. Write your software from there. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but it's easier to move your business, if it's service-based, if it's people-based, than if it's big assembly plants. And you know, on this dimension, who is really stuck with country risk? If you're a natural resource company, right? If Vale doesn't like the way Brazil is evolving, what the heck is it going to do? Pull up its iron ore reserve and say, I'm going somewhere else with this. If you're the Venezuelan oil company and you don't like the way Venezuela is going, you can't exactly take your reserves and say, I'm going to take them to Chile. Chile will take you, but you can't take the reserves with you. So how much flexibility do you have? It's a qualitative judgment, but it's got to bring in. And finally, the words that strike terror in my heart when I think about country risk is when the government says, you're a company that's in the national interest. Scary words. You know what? Because you know what's going to come right after. If you're in the national interest, then the urge to meddle becomes almost unstoppable. I want to touch this. I want to touch that. No, I want... And once that happens, country risk becomes part and parcel. When we're in corporate finance, I mentioned my post on Petrobras. Go back and read it. It's pretty negative. But essentially, it shows you how the national interest can be used as a vehicle for driving a company into disaster. Because Petrobras was told to carry the weight of the country on its shoulders. Go out and become the largest oil company in the world. And guess what? They went after that with gusto, right? Reserves everywhere. The fact that they were spending incredible amounts to get these reserves, who cared? Their objective was, we have to be the largest. The top management, of course, is picked by the government. It's a national interest company. You see the dark side of the national interest kick in. So whenever I see the word national interest, it's my, like my lambda doubles. Because that's effectively what seems to happen. So those were the factors. The question is, how do you come up with the number? I'll give you the most simplistic device. And this is based just on revenues, again, because that's often the most easily accessible data. If you take Tata Motors and Tata Consulting Services, two Indian companies, both part of the same family group. Tata Motors in 2008 got 91% of its revenues in India. Tata Consulting Services got about 8% of its revenues in India. The typical Indian company in 2008 gets about 80% of its revenues in India. So basically, we average out across Indian companies, about 80% of the revenues for a typical Indian company comes from India. So here's what I did. I took the 91 and divided by 80, and I came up with the lambda 1.14 for Tata Motors. And I divided the 8 by the 80, and I came up with a lambda of about 0.09 for TCS. Very simplistic. But already you can see what's going to happen with lambdas. There are going to be some companies where the lambda is going to be less than 1, some where it's going to be greater than 1. That always has to be the case because you can't have every company in your market have a lambda less than 1 because then who's carrying the country risk? It's entirely revenue-based, so that's its limitation. And you do have to get that average across companies in your country, but this is one way to get a lambda. It's a very simplistic measure. Here's the... And with Tata Motors, I have to mention that that 91% changed almost overnight in 2009. Why? They bought Jaguar Land Rover, and when they bought Jaguar Land Rover, they bought a 35% revenue stream that's now become 50% of the revenues in Tata Motors. So today, when I value Tata Motors, I can't use the 91 and the 1.14 as my lambda because it's a different company. So here's my more expansive way of thinking about lambdas, and I'm not going to suggest it's easy. You know how we normally estimate betas? We'll come back and talk about this next session, but you run a regression of returns on the stock against returns on the market index, right? The slope of the line is the beta. I borrowed from the technology. I took the returns on a stock. In this case, I took two stocks. I took Embraer and Embratel. Embraer, of course, is the aerospace company. Embratel is the Brazilian telephone company. It's a telecom company getting 100% of its revenues in Brazil. And I ran regressions of those returns, the returns on these two companies, against what was then called the C-bond. But think of this as a Brazilian dollar-denominated bond, the returns on that bond. You know what's going to cause the returns on that bond to move a lot from period to period? It's not the base rate, which is the UST bond rate. It's the default spread for Brazil. So periods where Brazil is doing badly, these bonds tend to do really badly. Periods where Brazil is doing well, at least in the public perception, these bonds tend to do well. You see what I'm trying to compute? When Brazil's risk changes, and I'm capturing that through the C bond, you can do it with the CDS today, how much are these stocks affected? Why is that going to help me answer the question of what the lambda is? If I have a company that's completely insulated from country risk, it's figured out a way, even though it's a Brazilian company, to completely be protected, what should happen as Brazil's default risk goes up and down? Nothing. Conversely, if you're a company that swings wildly with the country risk, I should expect to see your lambda be a much higher number. And at least for these two companies, the numbers I got were consistent. For Embraer, the coefficient I got when I regressed returns on Embraer against the C bond is 0.27. For every 1% move in the Brazilian bond, in other words, the default risk, Embev moves only 0.27 times that change. But when I did the same thing for Embraer, 100% of its revenues in Brazil, for every 1% move in Brazil's risk, Embraer moves 2%. If you are interested in seeing this in play, take the 50 largest Brazilian companies. You can pull them off Capital IQ. Look at what's happened between September of last year and September of this year with each of these stocks, and see if you can make some sense of why some of these companies have been devastated a lot more by the increase in Brazilian country risk than others. Because that's what Lambda goes down to. Not all companies in a country are going to be equally affected by shifts in country risk. So different ways of dealing with it. I'll also tell you that the Lambda approach is a lot of work, and I almost never use it unless I have a company with a single emerging market exposure. Because if I did this for Coca-Cola, what would I have to do? I'd have to estimate lambdas against 72 countries. I am not going there. So if you have multiple countries, go with one of the first two approaches. Take a weighted average based on revenues, based on operations, put it in, multiply by 8, and move on. If you have a single country exposure, two countries that you can see the exposure to, then maybe this is the way to bring it in, is through a lambda. So to show you how different the numbers can be, I took Embraer in 2004. And I tried 5 different approaches for estimating the cost of equity, just to illustrate how different the numbers can be. The first was, I assumed that because they were a Brazilian company, I would just add remember the country risk premium for Brazil was 7.89% in 2004. I said, you're a Brazilian company, too bad. I call this the bludgeon approach. Every Brazilian company gets a 7.89% added. Cost of equity I got for Embraer was 17.24% in US dollar terms. Second approach, I brought the country risk premium and are weighted by revenues, that brings my cost of equity down to 9.59%. Third approach, I went back to location-based approach, and that pushes. So anytime I look at Embraer as a Brazilian company, and I forget about its revenue exposure, I come up with 17-18% as a cost of equity. Anytime I bring in where it actually gets its revenues, my numbers drop back to 9, 9.5, 10%. Is that going to make a big difference in evaluations, you think? Think of taking the same set of cash flows, discounting at 17% as opposed to 9 to 10%. Obviously, the numbers are going to be very different. In the case of Embraer, in my initial valuation where I used the 17 to 18%, I got a really low value and I concluded the stock was overpriced. When I replaced that 17 to 18% with a 9 to 10%, it shifted. It became a much more attractive company. And I'm convinced that this is something that the world is still wrestling with. As I said, most people out there still think of where are you incorporated, attached the country risk based on that. So I have a question. If you take this to its logical limit and you assume that most investors do the status quo, which is adjust for where the company is, and you're looking across companies in an emerging market. So let's say you have 50 companies in an emerging market. Right? So investors are using a 9% country risk premium for all of them to value these companies, but you're using finesse. You're looking at where the companies get it. So here's my question about the differences across those companies. Are you going to find emerging market companies with substantial exposure in developed markets to be significantly overvalued by equity research analysts or undervalued? So let's say you took Brazil right now. Let's say equity research analysts are punishing all companies for being Brazilian, attaching a big risk premium. What are they doing to companies like Embraer? They're going to undervalue those companies, right? Now let me ask you a tougher question. Let's say you think they're wrong, and I think they're wrong, and you go out and buy the companies. See, the market also reflects it, pushes the price down to that low value. Let's say you go out and buy those companies at the low prices. Why? Because you think intrinsically these companies are not that risky. What has to happen for you to make money? The truth has to come out, right? Then who's going to reveal it? You know what? And this has been, over the last 20 years, this has been one constant in my investment strategy. There's at least one or two companies every year that I buy. And I usually buy it after a market's gone through a crisis. And in emerging markets, it's not a question of whether that happens, it's a question of when it happens. So I wait for India, I wait for China, I wait for Brazil, I wait for a crisis, I wait for a meltdown. And I have a list of three or four companies like Embraer in these countries where I've always wanted them in my portfolio. And I'll buy them. And for the first few months after I buy them, only pain comes. Because they continue to go down because they're caught up in the market mood. You know how the truth comes out? Is you have earnings reports come out every 3 months. And with an Embraer, what you often find is those earnings reports are completely disconnected from the country. And after about the fourth earnings report, it takes a while for investors to catch on. Investors say, you know what? It's a Brazilian company, but it doesn't look very Brazilian in its earnings reports. Let's push the price up. I bought Embraer for the first time during Lula's first election in 2000. People might not remember this, but when Lula ran for president of Brazil, he was a socialist, and people were convinced the minute he got elected, he was going to nationalize everything. So, of course, as the lead into the election, stock prices in Brazil started to collapse. Massive correction across Brazil. Markets down. Bought Embraer for the first time in 2001, towards the end of 2001. One of the best investments I ever made. But I got lucky because there he came in, he didn't nationalize everything, things started to go back up, and you saw the Embraer adjustment to be much greater than everybody else because it did not deserve to be marked down as much as it did. So it's a strategy, but it's a strategy that comes with danger. You've got to be aware of it. So now, at least let me lay the foundations for what I'm going to offer you as an alternative to historical risk premiums. Remember the exercise we went through? You tell me how much you pay for something, I should be able to tell you what your equity risk premium is. So the way I describe this is an equity risk premium, don't listen to what people say. Look at what they pay. Because if you ask me, what's my equity risk premium? I could give you any number, 8%, 10%, 15%, 23%, because what does it matter to me? But when I pay for something, I'm paying with real money, that's going to be revealing of what my equity risk premium is. So what I'm doing is I'm replacing a backward-looking number with a forward-looking number. I want a number that is dynamic, not static. You know what I mean by dynamic versus static? My historical risk premium for 2000 and through the end of 2014 is not going to change much through 2015. It didn't change every day. So through August, when terrible things were happening to markets, my historical risk premium was 4.6, 4.6, 4.6, 4.6 every day. I'd like a risk premium that reflects what's going on. So for about 20 years on my website, I've been computing what I call an implied premium. And to see what the basis for the implied premium is, think about investing in a bond. So you pay the bond price up front. What are your cash flows going to be on the bond? You're going to get coupons, and you're going to get a face value, right? Remember how you compute the yield to maturity on a bond? Don't disappoint me here. How do you compute the yield to maturity on a bond? What do you do? What's the definition of yield to maturity in a bond? Come on. It's that discount rate that makes the present value of my cash flows equal to the price of the bond. It's an IRR on a bond, right? I'm stealing from that concept and applying it to the equity market. So let's go to the start of 2008. S&P 500 was at 1468.36. Unlike a bond, I'm not going to get a fixed coupon, but I can estimate what your cash flows are, and the cash flows are going to come from either dividends or stock buybacks of a U.S. company. So basically, I took the dividends and stock buybacks from the previous 6 years, normalized them, projected out what they will be based on what people are expecting the growth in earnings to be. So basically, I know what you paid for stocks. I know what your expected cash flows are. Beyond year five, I assume that you will continue to grow, but you will grow at the same rate as the economy, which creates an estimation problem for me. So here's what I use as my proxy. I use your risk-free rate, which is 4.02% at the start of 2008, as your growth rate in perpetuity. So let's set up the two problems. Instead of buying a bond, I bought the S&P 500. Instead of coupons, these are the cash flows I'm going to get, dividends and stock buybacks growing over time. What is the question I asked for the bond? What discount rate makes the present value of your cash flows equal to the price of the bond? That's that question for stocks. Start at 2008. That discount rate, and it's a little messier than a bond because the cash flows are changing, but if you use the solver function in Excel, the number you'd have got at the start of 2008 would have been 8.39%. You subtract out the risk-free rate, there's my implied equity risk premium at the start of 2008. Now, of course, the reason I picked 2008 was later in 2008, we had the crisis. What was the crisis? Well, every day you woke up, markets were moving 50%, no, 15%, 10%, 8% in a day. So let's do some very simple what-if dynamics on this equity risk premium. So risk premium is 4.39%. It comes from the level of the index, the expected cash flows, and solving for that discount rate, right? So if I held everything else constant, and on January 2nd, the index jumped 10%. It goes up by 10%. So just think in terms of cash flows and price. What's going to happen to my equity risk premium? Is it going to go down or go up? Same cash flows, higher price up front. Do I need a lower discount rate to get to that value? The discount rate has to go down, right? Lower discount rate, higher value. So my every time stocks go up, equity risk premiums come down. Every time stocks go down, equity risk premiums go up. And that, to me, is the way the world should be, because what do we talk about? A crisis when markets collapse. Markets collapse, you're scared. When you're scared, you demand a larger risk premium. Guess what? With the implied premium, you're going to get a result that reflects that intuition. Holding all else constant, if earnings jump by 10% on January 2nd, so same level of the index, so we've gone back to the old level, I now have higher cash flows. What's going to happen to my equity risk premium? Is it going to go up or go down? Going to go up? Everybody agree? Because I need a higher discount rate to make. So if stock prices go up, equity risk premiums go down. If earnings go up by 10%, equity risk premiums, what if they both go up? Then there'll be no change. Do you see where I'm going? For equity risk premiums to change over time, it's not just stock prices going up. It's not just earnings changing. It's how they change relative to each other. So over the last 6 years, have stock prices been going up or down collectively? It's been a bull market, right? We're up, what, 100, 120% since the lows? So if you held everything else constant, ask you, should equity risk premiums gone down or gone up? You're probably going to say, well, equity risk premiums should have gone down a lot. But you know what? Earnings and cash flows have gone up about 140%. Which means, if you look at equity risk premiums today, they're actually higher than they were in March of 2009. So it's a relative movement of stock prices versus earnings that determines what happens to equity risk premiums. And of course, if you look at just at 2008, 1 year later, January 2009, after the crisis, the equity risk premium, remember it started the year at 4.37%? By the end of the year, it was at 6.43%. That was a really bad year, in case I have to tell you that. It was a really bad year because stock prices collapsed a lot more than earnings and cash flows dropped by. Not surprising the equity. To me, that's the definition of a market crisis. In a market crisis, the price of risk changes dramatically. It's not the earnings or the cash flows. And if you think back over the last month, the month of August, I mean, it's not like you got huge information about earnings and cash flows, right? But you saw stock prices go all over the place. That's exactly what happens when the price of risk changes on a day-to-day basis. And I'm going to leave you with one final graph. This is actually on a day-to-day basis what happened from September 12th of 2008. That was the day before Lehman collapsed, all the way through December 31st of 2008. Every day I computed the implied premium, partly to show how dynamic the number was, how much it could change in a day. And there was a day in November where the equity risk premium in the U.S. was higher than 8%. November 18th, 19th, someday like that. To me, this is the graph that reminds me that I can never, ever sit on an equity risk premium and keep using it over and over again. Since that point in time, every time I value a company, I use the equity risk premium at the start of that month. So in fact, September of 2015, the equity risk premium at the start of this month was 6.2%. That's what I've been using in my valuations this month. What will I use in October? I don't know yet. October 1st, I've got to recompute the number. But I have to recognize that I have to be a price taker when it comes to equity risk, and this is a number that I constantly have to monitor. So when we come back on next Monday, we're going to start with the implied premium and use it as a basis for re-estimating that base number for mature markets.
Pushing in the wrong direction, you're going to go against what your gut is telling you about risk.
Yeah.
Whereas with implied premium,
sure, the discount rate would increase.
Exactly. Which is what I think is
interesting. Okay, thanks.
Just curious, so you talk about like several methods for equity risk premium, and then there's the implied equity risk premium. Which one do you usually use then? Do you use the bottoms up method?
The implied premium is a choice for the base premium. Whether uh-huh. what I use is my premium for the U.S. I have a choice of going either with the historical data or the implied premium. So if I went with the historical data, that whole page of risk premiums would be built off the base of 4.6%. Because I went with the implied premium at the start of 2015 was 5.75%.
Okay,
so what it changes is the base number from which you build off is going to be a very different number if you go with an implied premium for the U.S. as opposed to historical.
So the page you published with like the map and the,
right.
the
based
numbers
off
is based on
the base number is an implied premium for the U.S.
Oh, I see. And it's the implied plus the country risk premium.
Exactly.
That, okay, I see.
There is another way of avoiding the country risk premium in time, which is if I compute an implied equity risk premium for every country, just like I did for the S&P 500.
Uh-huh.
I could actually do that whole page with just implied premiums.
And would you get the same number?
No. Because then you're taking in what. So if you have a one, let's say you have China in a bubble. What's the definition of a bubble? Your implied premium is too low. You could actually end up with a 5.75% premium in the U.S. and a 4% premium in China.
Uh-huh.
Now, fundamentally, you're saying that makes no sense. But to the extent that you have a bubble and people are forced to invest in that market because it's Chinese investors, you have to. You could actually end up with implied premiums that are actually very different from those built up.
I see. So, sorry. So, in the case of China, where it's a bubble, your implied will be lower.
Much, much lower.
Than the...
Exactly.
Okay.
In fact, that's one way in which you can use, as a portfolio manager, to decide what markets you want to avoid, is if you get implied premiums that are much, much lower than what you see on that picture, you're saying, you know what, that doesn't make sense to me.
I see.
I'm going to avoid that market.
And just curious, have you ever back-tested your model?
factors in what sense? Because like, I'm not making any predictions about market direction, right?
Like, I mean, say you calculated market, like you did a valuation for a company, but you used data since 2000.
Well, remember the joint test you're running. You're testing your equity risk, you're testing value, you're testing earnings, you're testing. So if it works, you have no idea why it worked, whether you got lucky. If it doesn't work, you don't know why it didn't work. So back testing an individual company is almost.